call the Committee on Business, Industry, and Jobs to order. We're going to get a UI fund update this afternoon from Mr. Commissioner McElroy and Mr. Lee Nelson. So let us know what's going on in the unemployment area. Welcome, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for the opportunity. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We've provided at your place a copy of the 2009 calendar year annual report. For this presentation, we're going to use a set of paper slides that look like this, and they should be in your background. There are a lot of facts and figures here. I'm going to go through them quite quickly. The bottom line, very honestly, is that we continue to be in a deep recession. We continue to have a lot of people unemployed. We are paying them unemployment benefits on a timely basis. The unemployment trust fund is in deficit and will continue to be in deficit for some time, but that's an orderly process provided for in federal law, and it's not in danger of running out of money, so we can't pay people's benefits. But starting on the first slide, in 2009, 363,000 people applied for benefits. 351,000 received payments. That compares, you'll see, to 2008, where the numbers were about a third higher in 2009 than in 2008. During 2009, 84% of the people who received benefits filed online, 16% contacted us by phone. And we're going to have some phone statistics a little later in the presentation. Our UI benefits are generally half of an applicant's average weekly wage in a four-quarter base period preceding their becoming unemployed. Our maximum unemployment benefit went up last fall to $585, and the maximum for the states around us is shown at the bottom of page 3. The average weekly benefit is $393 a week, and that's the fourth highest in the nation. The average duration of benefits, and the latest numbers we had for these were through the third quarter, was 18.4 weeks. But the news, the real news, isn't that good, very honestly. That includes people who are off for a week or two and get averaged in to a number with people who are off 30, 40, 50, or 60 weeks. And so this is the number, the way we compute it for the federal government, and it's accurate. But it masks the fact that there are an increasing number of people who have been unemployed for too long. Page 5 shows the amount of benefits currently available, and it's 86 weeks. We had a brief period last summer when we had 92 weeks of benefits, but when Minnesota's unemployment rate went below 8.5%, the number went down to 86 weeks. We are dependent on the federal Congress to renew the middle portion of this, Federal Emergency Unemployment, or EUC. The current law providing EUC expires on the 28th of February of this year. Congress is debating an extension. If that does not happen, we will slip back from 86 weeks to 39 weeks.
What's your guess on that, Commissioner? Extend it?
It seems hung up on politics. No one will say they're opposed to it, but they have some problems with the federal PAYGO rules and with how long they're going to extend it for and with whether they're going to include a debt ceiling limit increase with it. And we're not only would like to see it passed, but it would be helpful if it passed this week or early next week so we don't have to take people off benefits and put them back on again. We are obligated to send letters to people telling them the program is coming to an end, and that unduly frightens people about their benefits, where if they elect to renew it and do it before, I believe it's the 22nd of February, then we will be able to have people on benefits continuously.
I'm surprised that politics are in play there in Washington, D.C.
Page 6 shows the amount of benefits paid during 2009. The total is $2.8 billion in benefits. Mr. Fuller and I were just having a discussion about the economic impact of that. We think that a fair impact analysis is about a multiplier of 2.2 times that of the impact on communities and the impact on local merchants and cash registers and clinics and churches. So if that's correct, the total impact of those benefits is about $6.5 billion in 2009. That's up from $1 billion in benefits in 2008. Starting on page 7, we talk about we are measured by the U.S. Department of Labor as to timely first payments, and we're required to pay 87%.
Excuse me, before that, Senator Tomassoni.
Commissioner, do you have a number on how many people received the benefits?
Yes.
First pay.
351,458 during 2009.
That equated to the $2.8
billion. Oh. Okay. You can't take the $2.8 billion and divide by that number. It's more accurate to divide by the weeks of benefits paid. We know that the average weekly benefit that was paid was $393. Federal requirement is that we make first payment within 14 days, and that's calendar days, not working days, of an application. And that includes the time it takes to send a questionnaire to an employer if there is a question as to whether someone was laid off for lack of work. And we meet that standard 90% of the time. The national average is 82% of the time. And there were 35 states below the standard in 2009. Minnesota was only one of two states, Minnesota and Alaska, who had a better performance in 2009 than in 2008. And that's largely both because we have a really super staff and because of this investment made in a new system in 2007. Telephone calls, we took 1.25 million operator-assisted calls during 2009, and the average wait time was under 5 minutes. Now, in fairness, it was longer than that on Mondays and less than that on Fridays. We experience significantly higher call volumes on Monday and Tuesday and lower volumes on Friday, but the week-long average was about 5 minutes.
How many people are doing that, receiving these calls for you?
On a typical day, there'll be between 150 and 180 people on call center. If this morning, which was yesterday morning, rather, the day after a holiday, it may have been a little more than that. We need to have some people doing the decision-making on files, looking at files to determine if people are eligible, so not everybody who's trained for phones can be on phones at any one time or we fall behind on decision-making. But it's not unusual to have 180 people on phones, and they're in St. Paul and St. Cloud. The statistics for the week, for last week, the week ending the 13th, we had 7,350 new applicants. That's higher, much higher than in a pre-recession second week in February. But we have seen the numbers start to come down a little over the last few weeks. Number of weeks of benefits paid, 227,000. So to Senator Tomassoni's question, how many people are paying or getting paid, it was the 380 over the whole year. But even just last week, there were 227,000 paid. The highest number we have paid in 1 week is 240,000. That breaks down into regular and extension, 137,000 on the regular program and 89,000 on the extension. We paid $72 million in benefits. We had 184 people exhaust their benefits, meaning run out of all of the programs, including the extensions. That is... that's a lot of families. It is a small percentage. That number will get worse because of when the layoffs started, but we're also hopeful that we're seeing some improvement in the number of jobs listed in our system. We maintain a job bank, and I'd invite you to look at it, minnesotaworks.net. At the end of December, it had 16,000 listings. At the end of January, it had 21,000 listings. This morning, it had 36,000 listings, and we have seen a significant increase in listings in the last 2 weeks. And so I'm hopeful that that means employers are starting at least to think about hiring, but I would not confuse that with the fact it's easy to get a job. We're going to release on the 2nd of March our latest job vacancy survey. We survey 5,000 employers about whether they're hiring or not, and we expect there are an awful lot more people looking for work than there are job vacancies. We know there are. The number of operator-assisted phone calls last week was 27,000.
Senator Carlson, did you have a question on that?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Commissioner, when you're talking about the statistics for February, and you said there are 7,350 new applications and 184 where the benefits have been exhausted, that 184 is for this week also, and is that number of people exhausting beginning to match the people applying, or is that falling away?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, it is the number of people during that week that ran out of benefits, for whom that was their last week of benefits. It's a much smaller number, thankfully. And I can't tell you how fast it's going to go up. It will get bigger. Lee may have some idea of what the anticipation is. But thankfully, many, many people do get jobs before they run out of benefits, the majority. All right.
Okay.
And then the average wait time last week was 3 minutes and 19 seconds. It will be a little worse than that this week because of a four-day week. All right. Number 10, on page 10, we get to the issue I think you are most interested in, and that's the trust fund balance. We anticipate, or we show you here, total annual receipts, benefits paid, and the trust fund balance as of 12/31. At the end of 2008, we had $496 million in the state unemployment insurance trust fund. At the end of last year, we were in deficit by almost $287 million. We're anticipating that the end of this year will be in deficit $831 million. It will peak in 2011 at $1,097,000,000, and that we will get out of deficit in late 2015 or early 2016.
How does that, Commissioner, work? usually the math is receipts subtracting
you need to
benefits. It doesn't add up.
It does if you take just starting on the second column, if you take 496 and add to that the 943,547.
Okay, that's how you get. I get it. It's a running. Okay, I get it.
It's a running total.
Yeah, I get it.
And so the deficit for the year has to be added to the balance or deficit from the.
Okay, it's a carryover. Okay.
Now, where does this money come from? It comes from the Federal Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. If the Federal Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund runs out of money, they have an unlimited credit line with the U.S. Treasury. Now, it is not. Obviously, it's real money. It adds to the federal deficit if necessary. It's paid back by Minnesota employers, both through a falling fund surcharge and through their experience rating, and potentially through a change in the federal unemployment tax, the net tax, because of a credit that's withdrawn. The page 11 simply shows in graphical form the information that was on the table on page 10, which is the trust fund balance. On page 12, we get into the issue of borrowing. There are 28 states that have borrowed from the trust fund so far. The highest is California. The lowest is South Dakota. We look at these numbers in comparison to what we've done in the past. Minnesota has borrowed in 75 through 78, 80 through 85, and 2003 and 2004. In the past, and we asked the question, how much are we borrowing compared to total wages? And in 1983, our balance of $351 million was 1.5% of total wages. The deficit that we had at the end of last year, $286 million, was 0.3% of total wages. Payroll has gone up that much. We're projecting that at its peak, when we get to owing the federal government $1 billion, that'll be a little over 1% of payroll. We are not paying interest this year. The ARRA Act passed in February of last year waived the interest through the end of this year. When we owe interest, it's based on a comparison to various federal funds. For last year, it would have been 4.64%. Currently, I haven't asked to have calculated. It would probably be fairly similar to that. Is that correct, Lee?
Close.
The state unemployment taxes are, we go into it on 2014, or on page 14 rather, excuse me. In 2010 through 2015, the base UI tax rate remains the same, and it's maximum by law. In 2010, the base rate will bring in approximately $250 million. The remaining $800 million comes from the experience rating portion of the overall UI rate based on the number of layoffs that an employer has had. And the experience rating portion will bring in an additional $200 million each year from 2011 to 2013 because of the number of layoffs that employers have had over the last 2 years. An experience rating is set over a four-year period of time. And if a company has layoffs that exceed the base rate, they're going to be paying more in unemployment insurance taxes. There is also a think we show on page 15, the federal FUTA tax goes up if we are in deficit and have stayed in deficit. And so we expect that to go up between now and 2015 by the numbers shown on page 15. And it is not insignificant. It goes up $56 a worker in 2011 and up to as much as $140 a worker in 2015. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Buck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, the $56 a worker, is that just an average number, or how is that assessed? Is it assessed per dollar of payroll?
Lee can help me with that, please.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, an employer pays the tax on the first $7,000 of wages paid per employee, and the effective rate after you take in the credits is 0.8%. So 0.8 times 7,000 is $56. So most employers pay $56 a worker. If you paid somebody less than 7,000, you would pay correspondingly less per worker.
So back, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson. So are employers currently paying $56 on that first $7,000 on payroll, and then the $77, the $98, that assumes some kind of a surcharge in that rate. Is that in addition to the 56, or is that the total amount?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, that will be the total amount. It will go up by $21 a year. It's fairly complicated. We tried to set it out here to make it fairly simple. It's actually it goes into a loss of federal tax credits. But the net effect is, because Minnesota will be in borrowing status, employers will see their federal tax rise, and that portion will then be used to pay back the deficit. It's the way the feds have if a state won't take other means of paying it back, there's an automatic federal tax increase to pay it back.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we do take means to pay it back. We have a falling fund surcharge that increases the base rate by a tenth, and we have the four-year experience rating that bring in more dollars. But despite that, because of the amount we will need to borrow, we will likely have these surcharges through 2015.
And, Mr. Chairman, then, Mr. Nelson, so is there no federal surcharge until 2012 on Minnesota employers? Is that, I mean, are we kind of off the hook until hopefully we get through this recession?
Or? Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we're at essentially the federal base rate, which is that $56, and it doesn't go up until 2012.
But
that to answer you,
Commissioner, state rates are going to go up.
State rates are, the rates go up because more benefits have been paid. The percentages are not going up, but people will pay more because if they've had layoffs, and across the board, we're going to see an increase of about $200 million a year.
And Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, what is the current maximum rate that an employer pays as a percentage of payroll up to what is the cap amount? Or
Let's see if I can remember what Mr. Nelson has taught me. The wage base is $28,000 a year. $27,000, excuse me. And I believe the maximum rate is 9.6%.
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bott, it's a little more complicated than that because of surcharges. The effective rate is going to come out at about 10.3% on the first 27,000 per worker. So a little under $3,000 a worker
and
would be the maximum an employer might pay.
And
they'd have to have a large number of layoffs in relation to their payroll to reach that.
And then, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, what is if a company has a really, really low experience rating, the lowest you can get, they don't lay anybody off, what do they pay as a percentage of payroll?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, they're going to pay effectively about 0.7% on that first 27,000 per worker is the effective rate.
Mr. Nelson, don't you think there's a problem there? I mean, employees that have to lay people off, don't we create with this a real impediment for them to rehire and take a chance of laying more people off? And then businesses that have real stable employment pay almost no payroll income taxes. And the burden of this, three-fourths or more of the burden of unemployment, doesn't fall on the entire workforce. It only falls on the piece of the workforce that has some volatility in employment. I mean, it seems like we could spread this burden across more employers and make it easier for the employers that have volatility in employment. I mean, this adds real cost to construction, real cost. While other businesses that don't experience layoffs, whatever they are, if they're a fast food restaurant or whatever, have almost no cost of payroll, less than 1%. Just seems we could spread the burden better.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I think from other employers you would hear, we have structured our employment in such a way, or we've made sacrifices to profits in some cases to not lay people off. And I think the transition to a different system would be somewhat challenging. We don't believe states around us. We can do a little research. There's a national database and see if there are other states that do it that way. Because the way the maximum rate works, once a company reaches the maximum rate, there isn't an additional cost. You know, they've maxed out. And the people they compete with in the same industry are faced with the same challenges. So certainly a discussion that I think would provoke a great deal of interesting comment from the business community on both sides.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, if you want to bring an employee back, and you hear about this jobless recovery, if you have a bad experience rating, 10% of your payroll cost is associated with that first dollar of payroll up to the first 28,000. That's a pretty big impediment to rehiring people when you got 10% of payroll just for unemployment. You know, in what we all read is this jobless recovery. I just think it's something maybe we need to have a discussion about it. Maybe it takes years to ever get some agreement on it, but if we're not going to be able to rehire people, I think we need to be careful that we don't put too many obstacles in the way.
Mr. Chairman, I will ask our economist to give this some thought and to take a look at what's done in other states. One argument would be that this is factored into construction prices or into the prices of other seasonal industries, but I think it would be an interesting discussion.
And Mr. Chairman, it might not just be construction. It could be manufacturing-type businesses, which we're trying very hard to hang on to in this country. It just seems like a pretty high hurdle for a slow economy it doesn't seem like we're trying to incent businesses to rehire people. Seems like we're just kind of putting more things in the way. Just seems like a discussion we need to have considering the recession.
Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, we have these discussions very frequently in our Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. And consistently we've heard from the business community saying they prefer the employers who have the layoffs to be assessed the cost of those layoffs rather than spreading it to an employer who doesn't lay people off. And so I can tell you this, Minnesota is the most experience-rated state in the nation by a fair amount. Only Utah comes close. And that is what the business community has strived for, assess the cost against the employers who have layoffs.
So, Mr. Chairman, my instincts are right. Maybe we're really an outlier.
Okay, the commissioner, Mr. Nelson, are going to look further into that.
Mr. Chairman, simply on page 16, we make the observation that Congress is likely to take up the issue of state borrowing and whether or not they will charge interest. We expect at least the potential of some changes in federal law, and our recommendation is that we stay with our current system of repayment and await changes in the federal law, if there are any, and we would keep you informed as to what those are. But under current law, we would take about 5 years to pay out of the current deficit.
Mr. Chairman, I just thought of one more question.
Back. Senator Back.
Commissioner, a new startup business, if I decide I want to start up a little business and bag some of Senator Scoy's potatoes before they leave the farm, if I'm a new startup business and I want to enter into a contract with him and hire some people, what kind of rate do I get as a new employer first day out of the chute?
Lee, can you help me with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, you get the average rate for all employers. What we do is statute provides you compute a new business rate, and it actually works out to the average rate if you took all employers and considered them as one, and it's currently about 2.8%, I believe, on that first 27,000.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at on page 14 where they've got $250 million comes in with the base rate and $800 million comes in with the experience rating. Then you're going to have some more on the experience rating later, but let's just focus on that. Do you know how many employees are in the $250 million and how many are paying into the $800 million? Do you have any feel for that?
Good question. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scoy, about 2.1 million workers. This does not include nonprofit or government employees. This is strictly for profit. So you're looking at about 2.1 million workers.
And do we know what percentage of employers are at the minimum rate?
Mr. Chairman, members, 70% of all employers in Minnesota are at those base rates. Most employers are very small, never had any layoffs. 5% of Minnesota employers are at the maximum. About 7,000 employers are at the maximum rate. And one of our discussions in the advisory council is that about $120 million is charged to those maximum rate employers to which the fund doesn't recover, $120 million a year. So those maximum rate employers are currently not covering the costs of their laid off workers.
But
Letter back.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nelson, the rest of the employers need that piece of the economy. You know, we can't just because that piece of the economy doesn't pay for itself doesn't mean the rest of the economy doesn't depend on it. And to say somehow they're beating up the system because their industry doesn't pay for itself, I mean, maybe I should be on that unemployment. Never been on that unemployment advisory council, but I think there's some discussion needs to happen there. If
Fuller, is that my appointment? No, I guess I can't. I can't appoint you today. I wish it was.
It just seems like, Mr. Chairman, it just seems like we are disproportionately burdening areas of our economy that can do little about the volatility that they have, but they're still important to our economy. And just because they happen to be in a volatile sector, it seems like we ask them to carry an awful lot of the load because of the nature of their occupations.
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner.
There is one senator always on the commission. Right now it's Senator Bonoff, but visitors are always welcome, and we'd be happy to let you know when they meet. They meet mainly in the office outside the legislative session. I would say that although your instincts about construction are correct, many construction companies are high-rate employers. They're not all the high-rate employers. Golf courses tend to be high-rate, landscaping companies, some other industries that are highly seasonal.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and tracking along with where Senator Bach has been leading this discussion. I think when you think about insurance, you know, I mean, if you read the dictionary definition, it's, you know, everybody pays a little bit so that when somebody has needs, you know, they can have that insurance payment. What we do when we move more and more toward experience rating is you tend to penalize those that have the needs. And so that's what's going on here. Appears to me that if 70% of the, or whatever that number was, are in that lowest rate, it would be a very small impact to them, but could yield significant impacts to our overall economy as we encourage these landscapers and these other businesses to be able to hire another employee. I mean, these are the first time jobs for lots of people, and you're getting them into the workforce. I think, Senator Bach, you're on to something that we ought to be looking at.
Okay. Senator, Commissioner, I think any further questions?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the update. We're going to get right into the legislative auditor's report.
Seems like there's an issue.
Workforce programs. Welcome to the committee, and Mr. Nobles and Ms. Hauer, evaluation manager on this one, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota, and with me at the table is Jody Hauer, who is the manager of our evaluation. Mr. Chairman and members, as I think all of you know, every year the Office of the Legislative Auditor asks you, legislators and others, what topics, issues, programs, departments, agencies do you think we should evaluate? And last year, as we typically do, we received many requests, 50, 60 different proposals for evaluations, but with our staff we can only conduct about 6 or 7 a year. And workforce programs was one of the topics that legislators, more than any other, wanted us to evaluate. And I think the presentation that you just heard is part of the reason, because we really do have a significant unemployment situation and a difficult economy. Workforce programs need to work effectively even when we're not in such tough times, but they especially need to be effective in circumstances like we're in now. They also need to work effectively because we spend a fair amount of money on them, about $234 million in fiscal year 2009. I think legislators also wanted this evaluation because there's been concern among legislators in both the House and Senate about the rather complex structure that exists for the administration of these programs. As you're going to hear, there's really a vast array of them, and the structure by which they are implemented is fairly complex. I think legislators have also raised questions about how should we measure these programs in terms of their performance, and we're going to talk about that as well. So, Madam Chair, we are prepared to present to you the results of our evaluation, and I'd like to turn to Ms. Hauer to do that.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am Jody Hauer. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Before I summarize our report, I would like to introduce the two other members of the evaluation team who worked with me on this evaluation. They're in the audience, David Kirchner and Julie Tupke-Bastidas worked with me on the evaluation. I'm going to start by giving an overview of our findings, and then I'm going to spend a little bit of time giving some detail about each of those findings. I do want to mention that the report does contain some additional findings that I'm not going to cover today, just in the interest of time. But overall, we concluded that participants in some of the workforce programs have had some positive outcomes, and I will explain more about that in just a moment. But we've also saw some problems, and one of those was with how the performance of the workforce programs is actually measured. The administration of the workforce programs is fragmented. We've got state, we've got local government, and we've got nonprofit organizations all involved, and there's fragmentation throughout the system. The funding of the workforce programs is segregated by program, with little chance for meeting needs that happen to fall outside of the definition of those programs that are already receiving the funding streams. Workforce programs are not fully integrated with one another, and we discovered that that leaves some gaps in service. And the final conclusion that I'll be talking about today is that some of the service providers who receive funding through the workforce program system are being selected without having a competitive process for identifying and selecting those providers. And that produces some accountability problems. Again, I'll talk about that in more detail in just a moment. First, let me set some context for the Workforce Investment System. The Federal Workforce Investment Act is the federal legislation that requires states to develop one-stop centers to house a variety of workforce programs. And in Minnesota, those one-stop centers are what we call the workforce centers. As of the end of 2009, Minnesota had 49 workforce centers. Those are the dots. They come up as parentheses here, but they were dots originally on this slide. In any event, there are 49 of them as of the end of last year. And Minnesota has 16 workforce service areas. They are shown on this slide by the white lines representing the boundaries. Each one of those workforce service areas has a local workforce council. Members of those workforce councils are appointed by local elected officials. And they largely oversee the federal programs for adults, for youth, and for people who are laid off from their jobs. Those are referred to as the dislocated workers. Now, the set of services that are available through the workforce centers varies a little bit from center to center, but there are some fundamental services that are available throughout all of those workforce centers at no charge to the user. That includes things like access to the online job bank. The centers are also the home base for those federal programs I mentioned, those set up with federal money for adults, dislocated workers, and youth. The federal act does require that some services and certain types of information be available at each one of those workforce centers. For example, information must be made available on the occupations that are in demand locally and also on how to apply for unemployment insurance. The workforce system has a mix of service providers. We've got the state's Department of Employment and Economic Development, which provides one set of services, and we've got local governments and some nonprofits that actually operate the workforce centers around the state. They've got their own set of services. There are some other services, such as adult basic education, that the federal act requires to be provided through the workforce centers, but they're not necessarily housed within those workforce centers in a physical sense. Although some of those adult basic education classes are being held at some of the workforce centers in Minnesota. Then we have another layer. Outside of that sort of main system of workforce centers, a number of nonprofit organizations also offer a set of workforce services, mostly for specific populations, such as refugees, as one example. And we estimated that in fiscal year 2009, Minnesota spent $234 million of federal and state money on these workforce programs. That amount excludes about $11.5 million that came as one-time stimulus money from the federal government. Well, I'm going to talk next about how we looked at whether these programs are effective. And one of the things we wanted to know was, what are the long-term outcomes for the people who are in the workforce programs? And an important issue there is, what would have happened had a person not participated in a program? And of course, it's not easy to answer how someone would have fared without having done something. But what we did is put together a comparison analysis. We statistically matched participants in some of the workforce programs, specifically that federal adult program and the federal dislocated worker program, as well as the state's dislocated worker program. We matched those program participants with other people who had filed for unemployment insurance but did not participate in those programs. We matched them on a number of characteristics like age, gender, location in the state, work history, prior wages earned, and a number of other things, so that we had very similar groups, except for the fact that one of the groups had participated in the programs, the other had not. What we found was that when compared with the unemployment applicants who did not participate in the workforce programs, the participants were generally more likely to have employment. And that effect extended out for a period of 4 years after they had entered the program. In addition, we estimated that the participants earned more money than the non-participants, even though they had similar characteristics in other respects. I'm going to give you one example here. because we did find some differences in that earnings finding that I'll talk a little bit about here. This particular chart shows our results for women who had participated in the adult program. And if you look along the bottom axis, the bottom horizontal axis, what we have there is just the set of 4 years we looked at. They're divided by quarters. So we've got 16 quarters for the 4 years. On the left-hand side, that axis represents the difference in earnings between the participants and the non-participants. Our yellow line then on that graph shows that for the participants in this particular program, the adult program, they earned about $500 more than the non-participants over that period of time. And as you can see, the trend line actually trends upward. So over that four-year period, they actually earned more on a quarterly basis than did the non-participants.
So a question from Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Ms. Hauer. Do you have any information about the nature of the participants other than their enrollment in this program? I mean, are we talking about dissimilar populations, or is everything else kind of equal other than this?
Madam Chair and Senator Skoy, the populations that we compared were relatively equal, except for the fact that they participated or they didn't participate. Now, what we can't account for in a statistical sense is a personal motivation, which, of course, is part of an explanation for whether someone gets a job. That can't be accounted for. But in terms of other factors, we had pretty similar matched groups statistically.
Madam Chair, well, the motivation, I mean, a more motivated person would take the effort to get into the program and then therefore be motivated to work too. But yeah, very good.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, that's certainly true.
Very good, thank you. Okay, please continue.
Yes, and so I wanted to make one point about the difference between what we found for women and for men, because when we looked at the men who had enrolled in the adult program, we did see a little bit of a difference in earnings, but that did not last. And so there wasn't any lasting impact on the wages earned over the four-year period that we looked at. And we don't have a perfect explanation for why that is the case, although we speculate that it has something to do with the fact that the recession that we still are in, the economists tell us, had a disproportionate effect on the jobs that males tend to traditionally occupy. And we think that is at least in part an explanation for why the group that we examined over that four-year period did not have as much of a difference in earnings than the women did.
Never thought I'd ever accuse it.
Okay, thank you.
Psychology, sociology.
So that comparison of the participants and the non-participants is one way of objectively looking at how well the programs are helping the clients. We also thought it was important to look at what is the satisfaction of the clients who have recently used these programs. So we conducted a survey. We surveyed a sample of clients and received responses from over 800 individuals around the state. And the people that we surveyed indicated that they had some fairly positive responses to the services that they got, but substantially fewer of them were satisfied with the actual outcomes that they achieved as a result of those services. And let me give you an example here. This is just a partial display of our results, and it focuses only on people who had registered in one of those programs I described, the adult program or the dislocated worker program. But what we found from that group is that you can see very high percentages of those participants said that, yeah, the services, they liked the services. The staff knew how to help them. Those clients would come back again if they had the need. But then we asked them a second set of questions related to the actual outcomes as a result of using those services, and there the response wasn't quite as rosy. One example there in the middle, the 33% showed that for those who went through the program and received some services, even though they were pleased with those services, they felt that the services didn't necessarily connect them with employers who were hiring. And same is true with the other possible outcomes that we asked customers about. Now, you probably are aware that Deed conducts its own customer satisfaction survey. It does that on an ongoing basis over the years. But it does not ask its clients that sort of second set of questions about how pleased those clients were with the outcomes, with the results of having those services. So we recommend that Deed make some modifications to its customer satisfaction survey. We think it really should explore satisfaction with the outcomes. Over time, then, we think the department will be in a better position to judge whether that satisfaction really is tied to an economic downturn or how it might change when the economy swings upward again. Right now, they won't be able to know that because those kinds of questions aren't asked of the customers. I'm going to turn now to the next set of ways of looking at the measuring of the performance of the programs. The Workforce Investment Act, that's the federal act, it requires states
excuse me, Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Howard, on that last slide, the 39 and the 41%, those three categories, I mean, those aren't necessarily bad numbers, I don't think. But the other thing, is there some thought that they might be cumulative where they could have said yes to they didn't help me get a good job, but they did help me go to places that were hiring? Or they helped me advance? Do you get my point there? Could there be cumulative effects compared to the 89% who said that they were doing, because staff knew what they were talking about?
Right. Madam Chair and Senator, I do understand your point, and we did ask a series of questions about outcomes. So some might be that one of the possible outcomes was, was I connected with employers who were hiring, as opposed to did I actually get a job? And so we did have a series of questions, but we found that the same kind of dichotomy between their satisfaction with the services and the satisfaction with the outcomes.
Thank you.
And Senator Bonoff, question.
Madam Chair, Missouri, do you suspect that, you know, when somebody's not working, just the opportunity to interact and connect with somebody who cares would account for the high satisfaction versus the outcome?
Madam Chair and Senator, I certainly think that is the case. We had a number of the clients who we surveyed write in, and they had some very favorable comments about how helpful the staff were and how they didn't think they could have gotten along without the assistance they received. And so I think that certainly that kind of just a response to somebody who needs some help and going in and finding someone who's willing to give them some advice or some help certainly would color my perception of a service if I were the client.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Howard.
So moving on, there's a set of federal performance measures that the federal government requires all states to report. And for the federal adult and dislocated worker programs, those measures are, did the clients find a job? Pretty obvious. How long did they retain that job? And what were the average earnings? Now, states are subject to financial sanctions if they fail to meet targets set for them on these measures. If they fail to meet them for two consecutive years, they are subject to financial penalties. And on the converse side of that, when states meet their targets on these programs, as well as other targets that are set for adult basic education, but when those cumulative measures are met by a state, then the state becomes eligible for some incentive grants. The U.S. Department of Labor has money that it will then award to a state that has met its performance measures. So we've got some incentive for the providers to try to meet those targets that are set for them. Now, our review found that those measures have some flaws, and we talk about them at some length in our report. I'm only going to talk about two of them today. One is that currently a workforce program receives no greater credit when a person who has very limited schooling gets a job than it does when a skilled tradesperson who comes in with an Associate of Arts degree gets a job. So the measures will reward those programs that enroll individuals who have the strongest potential to do well. And this can lead to what we call selective enrollment, whereby the program providers are trying to enroll those people who are most likely to succeed. And they have an incentive to do that because they know that their funding is attached to meeting those performance targets. Now, I want to point out that this particular phenomenon is not something that we discovered. It's something that's well documented in the literature. The federal government is well aware of it. The U.S. Department of Labor is well aware of it. But we, in our research and talking to the workforce service area personnel, confirmed that incentive is out there. Another one that I'll point out today is that another flaw that we identified was that the measures really look only at very short-term outcomes, no more than 9 months after a client leaves the program. So we really don't have a good sense from these measures what happens a year out, 2 years out, 3 years out. So, and that's something that we think is a flaw. Another way of looking at performance, I wanted to point out that we looked at how performance is measured for certain nonprofit organizations in the state of Minnesota. We have 15 or 18, it varies a little bit from year to year, organizations that have received direct appropriations from the state of Minnesota to conduct, to provide their services. And these are mostly nonprofit organizations. They're largely, not exclusively, but largely located in the Twin Cities area. And some examples of them include Lutheran Social Services, the Alliance of Boys and Girls Clubs, Twin Cities Rise, and there are a number of others, about 18 of them. But we found that Minnesota has no standard measure of effectiveness for these nonprofit organizations. The organizations do measure their own performance. They are monitored, but because there isn't a standard way of looking at the performance, the results aren't comparable from one organization to the next. Now, you may recall that last year, 2009, the legislature did include in the Economic Development Omnibus Bill a provision that requires DEED to put together what is being referred to as the Uniform Accountability Report. And that report has DEED collecting certain data in a more standard way across these organizations, looking at things like what is the number of jobs affected by the program, what is the program's return on investment. And we concluded that the need for that is quite evident. We think that that data will help legislators and the public at large better understand what the outcomes are of these programs, because it will, for the first time, present some information that is comparable from organization, one organization to the next. But we think that additional information is needed. We don't think that that by itself is sufficient to really measure the performance of these programs, which can be quite complex. So we recommend that DEED put together a more comprehensive set of approaches for measuring performance, including those standards, the standardized measures that were part of the 2009 legislation, but going beyond that. And by going beyond that, what I mean is looking at things like measuring customer satisfaction with the outcomes, not just with the services themselves, making some comparisons of participants and non-participants, and seeing how on an objective basis they fare. Those kinds of things, combined with the information that would come from the Uniform Accountability Report, would provide a much richer array of information, allowing you and other policymakers to better understand how these programs actually compare.
So on that point, Ms. Hauer, I see on page 53 you list all of those programs. Were you able to do any sort of evaluation of which were most effective at all, or was this part of the issue, was that it was very difficult because there's no uniform set of standards to really evaluate them on?
Madam Chair, that is the case. I mean, we did look at the monitoring reports that DEED had produced on some of these organizations, and we had interviewed a small number of them, and they provided to us the way that they have their own performance measured. But what we concluded from that is it's not comparable. For instance, a number of them do calculate a return on investment for their own performance, but the methodology that they use varies dramatically from one organization to the next. So right now there isn't a set of measures that can, in a standard way, tell us how one fares next to the next, or one next to the other. All right, moving on then. We found that the authority over workforce programs is fragmented around the state. And by this, what I mean is that the state, meaning the Department of Employment and Economic Development, administers a set of programs. The local workforce service area operators, those that control the services provided through the workforce centers, at least most of them, have a second, separate set of services that they administer. And then we have the nonprofit organizations that administer yet another set of services. The funding streams that come in determine what services are provided. So federal funding that we get here for youth programs, for instance, has to be spent on youth programs and nothing else. Well, that in and of itself isn't a problem, but the problem comes in when there are needs that don't happen to meet the definition of those programs that are currently funded, because those needs then are left unmet. It's important to know that the structure we follow here and the programs that we provide are largely set out for us by federal law and federal regulations. The state is limited in terms of what it can do to change that. And we can't just say, oh, let's abandon that system. We do still have to operate within the structure set by the federal government. So that limits what we can do. Even if everyone were to agree that, yes, the fragmentation is too great, there's not a lot we can do there because we still have to abide by those federal regulations. But we do think that the fragmentation has led to some problems because some of the workforce programs are only partially integrated with one another, and that has left some gaps in service that I'm going to talk about next. In the report, we have several different examples where we think these gaps are evident, and they include the unemployment insurance system. They include the training that is provided through Minnesota State Colleges and Universities for laid-off workers, and it includes adult basic education. But today I'm going to focus just on the first. I'm going to talk next about the unemployment insurance system and what we consider to be a lack of a sufficient integration between workforce programs and unemployment insurance. Now, Minnesotans who want to apply for unemployment insurance do it by phoning into that central call-in center that Commissioner McElroy described to you a moment ago, or by going online. And as you heard, a lot of people are using the online service to do that. And that works well for most people. It has allowed the department to handle a huge volume of applicants for unemployment insurance benefits. But at the same time, it doesn't work well for everyone, and that's what we wanted to look at. So people who are not computer literate or people who have trouble with automated phone systems have often come into the workforce centers expecting that they can get some help. And what we found that is that's really not the case because the staff in the workforce centers are instructed to only refer people who have unemployment insurance questions back to that central call-in number or to the online site. Well, that leaves a lot of frustration, and we think that that leads to some gap in service. Now, the people who are in the workforce centers want to be able to help, but they're not trained to do it. There are some very complex employment situations that are brought in when clients want to apply, and the people in the workforce centers don't have the training to provide that kind of help, nor do they have access to the individual level data that would be necessary for them to answer the questions that these clients have about whether they're eligible, how much can they expect to receive, et cetera. We think that the breakdown really occurs when the people who are coming in looking for help are in a sort of a face-to-face situation, but then they get referred to a person-to-machine as opposed to a person-to-person interaction. And that just adds to the frustration for people who are already anxious and frustrated because they've lost their job, don't know what they're going to do to pay their bills, et cetera. So what we recommend in our evaluation is that the unemployment insurance division in the department take steps to ensure that help is available for clients who on their own have difficulty with the automated system that's been set up. Those kinds of clients should be able to connect more directly, not with another machine, not with a computer, not with an automated phone system, but instead with the customer service people who are on staff to answer those kinds of questions. So when workforce center staff have to refer them, they'd be referring those clients not to a machine, but instead to a person who can help them.
And a question from Executive Senator Koch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question just goes to, do you have some idea of numbers? I assume the lion's share of the folks use the computer and that's working. I know many that have, and it's helpful. But what do you have any idea of the numbers we're talking about percentage-wise that are very comfortable with the computer and then others that need help, the extra help?
Madam Chair and Senator Koch, I don't have a precise number for you, but what I can tell you is the only data that we know of that gives us some sense of the magnitude of the problem comes from some data that were collected last summer. Each one of the workforce centers was asked to, over a two-day period in June 2009, to collect information on how many calls that came in were related to unemployment insurance questions and how many people who walked through the door had unemployment insurance issues. And what they found in that two-day period, obviously not a representative sample, but in that two-day period, they found that a quarter of the calls were UI-related and a third of the visitors had UI-related issues. So, I mean, that's a fairly significant proportion of all of the various workforce issues that the staff are dealing with. So I'm afraid I can't give you, I don't think Indeed could either, tell you precisely the numbers of people who are in that group who can't handle the automated system. But we do know that it has taken up a significant share of the time for the staff in the workforce centers who are dealing with those people coming in with those kinds of questions.
Thank you.
And a follow-up from Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We had the same discussion recently around credit card purchase, you know, wanting to be able to use credit cards in person, and we couldn't do it. And so I come back to the same kind of thinking is, couldn't our staff in these workforce centers help these people by going to a carousel where there was a computer in the workforce center and walking them through? I think oftentimes people are just intimidated of doing it themselves. But if a staff person could be standing there right next to them and say, now we do this, now it's, you know, some people are more verbal. They need somebody to ask them the questions, read the screen, ask the question. Could that be a potential solution?
Madam Chair and Senator, in fact, some of that is already happening. I mean, there, you know, when we talked to the people in the workforce centers, they expressed a lot of frustration that they couldn't help the clients, but they admitted that sometimes they just did sit right next to the client and help them go step by step through the process. I think the problem occurred because of the crush of other people coming into the workforce centers for other services that the staff couldn't respond in as full of a way as they might have liked to do, to sit next, right next to them and go through the entire application process. So that's, I think, where the problem came in, because there were just so many other demands on the staff's time for the things that they were supposed to be focusing on, you know, working on employment plans with people who were seeking jobs.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm moving on then. The gaps in service that we identified, both with this UI system and some of the others that I'm not going to talk about today just because of time, we think result largely because of the existing funding arrangements and that fragmentation in authority over the programs that I've already mentioned. We think that the state could benefit from a process that would identify workforce needs that now go unmet. Because right now there isn't a single entity that has that charge. We are thinking about a process in which the workforce needs would actually drive the decisions about how dollars are spent, as opposed to the current system where the incoming flows of money determine what services are made available. And we think that's a very fundamental difference that would help change some of the problem in terms of the gaps in service that are out there. Now, we're not talking about this in terms of a way to replace what's now being done. We couldn't do that. We're talking really only on the margins, but in a way that might be able to respond to some of those needs that right now are being left unmet. We do recommend that the Governor's Workforce Development Council lead a design of such a process. And we think that the Governor's Council would be best equipped to do that because it has less of a self-interest in than would some others who are actually providing the services directly to the clients out there in the workforce centers. We do think the council should work both with DEED and the local workforce councils in designing that process, and the council should be responsible for setting some parameters about how that kind of a process would be implemented. It's true that if this were to be of any help, that some funding would be necessary, because once the needs are identified, you ask, well, how would they be then filled? And we talk about two options in our report. One possibility is using some of that incentive grant money that the state has earned over the last few years. I mentioned earlier that the U.S. Department of Labor will award these incentive grants when states have met their performance targets. So that's one possible source of money, because the state has quite a bit more discretion over the use of those dollars than it does for the dollars that come in specifically for programs for youth or programs for adults. And then the other option would be to use a portion of the state's workforce development fund. That, of course, would require legislative approval and a discussion, full debate by the legislature, but it is another option because those are state-generated dollars. They don't have the same strings attached to them as the federal dollars. Now, I referred earlier to the independent workforce organizations, most of which are nonprofits, and there are about 18 of them. They're nonprofit organizations that get the direct legislative appropriations. We've got another group, a smaller group, of three non-governmental organizations that receive a portion of the state's workforce development fund allocated to them by the Job Skills Partnership Board. And the allocations are specifically to provide services to the what are called the small layoff events. That's where fewer than 50 people are involved in the layoff. Now, those, just for by way of background, the Job Skills Partnership Board, which you are probably familiar with, but it's the entity that has some gubernatorial appointees, some legislative appointees. Part of its function is to allocate the dollars for the dislocated worker needs. It's that Job Skills Partnership Board that has provided some allocation. It has started at $500,000 for each of three different nonprofit organizations over the last several years.
So are these the organizations on page 61 and 62, Ms. Hauer? It may be of interest to people to see the groups that are being referenced.
Madam Chair, yes. We're talking about the three organizations listed in that table 3.3 on page 62. That includes Career Management Services, Quality Career Services, and Teamsters Service Bureau.
Very good.
Now, our office has, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, has over the last several years issued reports that have laid out principles and best practices for when the state awards grants to nonprofit agencies. And part of those principles and best practices are to make sure that when a grant is available, that information about the availability of that money is widely broadcast. Another part of the best practices is to select those providers who receive the money in an open and competitive process. When we compared those best practices and those principles with the process that's used to award legislative appropriations to these nonprofit organizations, we discovered that, our finding was that process now used really is a sidestep to the best practice process that we think ought to be in place, because it really does bypass the competitive selection of the nonprofit organizations. So we recommend that the legislature avoid listing in law the grant recipients and instead allow the selection of those providers through a competitive process. We think the legislature should set goals in terms of what it wants to see done, but it should leave the selection of the particular provider up to a more competitive and open process that would help ensure that the most qualified vendor is the one receiving the public dollars. And similarly, with the Job Skills Partnership Board, we think it, too, should change its process and establish a more open and competitive one for awarding grants to providers who might be interested in serving small layoffs, the people involved with the small layoffs.
So how would that look, Ms. Howard, that you would that we would make a direct appropriation to, say, the department, and they would have a competitive grant program that would and that it's how they would be selected, or working through another organization?
Madam Chair, that's certainly one option. And the Department of Employment and Economic Development has already in place several processes for selecting on a competitive basis vendors for other services. I mean, the one example that I think is probably most widely known is for the large layoff events, those with 50 or more people. Those are put out to bid. So when the department becomes aware of a large layoff situation, it will respond initially and assess the situation. Then it lets the qualified providers know about that, and the qualified providers who feel like they want to put a bid in on that and providing those services can do so. It's then up to the employees involved with that particular layoff event to make the decision among the various competing providers which ones they think would best help them with their services. So the department has already got in place that and really others as well that I could talk about. That does involve a competitive process so that which we think would meet the definition of a best practice selection process.
Very good.
Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, as I think Ms. Hauer said, but I want to just echo, I mean, we think it's certainly appropriate for the legislature to specify what you want accomplished. And that may be that you want a particular group of people served that you feel are not being adequately served. But again, we think if you do that, you lay out who you want to be served or the goals you want to be achieved, that it's better to leave it to the department in a competitive process to put out an RFP or however they're going to announce that and get a range of proposals. We think that population and those goals that you want achieved will be better served in a competitive process. And we also think, and I think Ms. Howard is going to come to this point, that there will be better accountability and monitoring after the fact, because over the years we have found that when you specify in law the grant recipient and you give the money to the agency or give it directly to the nonprofit, but you've named who is ultimately going to get the money, the agency says, well, the legislature named them, so we really don't have any responsibility for accountability or oversight. And so, again, that's a reason why we think if you leave this to the competitive grant selection process, that you will be able to achieve what you want, but you will also add greater accountability and oversight.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, members, my next point is really to what Jim Nobles just explained to you, and that is that we also took a look at what principles should guide the monitoring of state contracts when the state has awarded grants to nonprofit organizations. And those kinds of best practices include things like conducting at least one formal site visit with the organization during the period of the contract. It also includes following up on the results of the monitoring that does take place. And when we compared the principles for monitoring state contracts for the recipients of the direct legislative appropriations, we found that DEED does have the responsibility to monitor these nonprofit organizations that receive the direct legislative appropriations, but its monitoring has been inconsistent. In addition, the way it has funded its monitoring has been inequitable, and let me tell you more about that. One of the examples is that one of the organizations we happened to interview was one where there hadn't been an on-site monitoring visit for 5 years, and the reason that DEED gave us for not having as consistent a monitoring as they would like is that they don't get any funding to conduct their monitoring when direct appropriations are going to these nonprofit organizations. Now, what DEED has done is negotiate with some of these nonprofit organizations, asking them if they would set aside some amount of their appropriation for DEED's use in monitoring. But most of the, well, there were 15 organizations for fiscal year 2010 who had received direct appropriations. Three of them have carved off a piece of their appropriation for those monitoring purposes, but that leaves the dozen others that have not. And that's an inequitable situation that we think is not appropriate. So we recommend that DEED make its monitoring more consistent so that there is consistency among all the organizations that receive the public funding. And we further recommend that DEED develop a proposal for funding its monitoring and submit that proposal to legislators. Madam Chair, members, I'm going to just at this point sum up what we found and summarize our our recommendations, and then we can open it up to questions if you have any additional ones. One of the first things we talked about today was that the federal performance measures are inadequate for measuring the performance of programs. Another one of our findings is that the accountability for workforce programs is quite diffuse. There's fragmented authority over the programs, and the funding that comes into the state is segregated by individual programs. We have to recognize, though, that federal laws limit what the state can do to change that. Workforce center programs are only partially integrated with other workforce-related programs, and we think that lack of full integration leads to some gaps in service. Legislative appropriations to independent providers and the Job Skills Partnership Board's allocations for small layoffs bypass a competitive selection process that we think leads to some accountability issues. And then finally, DEED's monitoring of the providers who receive direct legislative appropriations is inconsistent and funded inequitably. So our quick summary of our recommendations. First, we think DEED should have a more comprehensive set of ways to measure the performance of programs. We think the Governor's Workforce Development Council should work along with the local workforce councils and DEED on developing a process to identify those local gaps in service. We recommend that DEED's Unemployment Insurance Division develop a way to make sure that people who come into the workforce center with unemployment insurance questions and have difficulties with the automated system can be connected directly with customer service staff who can help them. We recommend that the legislature allow recipients of workforce grants to be selected through a competitive process. And finally, we recommend that DEED more consistently monitor those nonprofit organizations and develop an equitable way of funding that monitoring. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my remarks, and as I said, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Hauer. A very complete report. So how long did it take you to work on this? I'm just wondering. It's very thorough.
Madam Chair, we started back at the end of April of 2009, and we're releasing it today.
Very good. Well, thank you. Are there any other questions? I know we might have some people who would like to also testify. So very good. Is the commissioner here? Are you have him on the list to testify, or someone from the department would like to respond? Oh, you're hiding back there. I didn't see you, Commissioner. Excuse me. You were...
Madam Chair, members, with me is David Nierman, and Dave is the Deputy Director of Workforce Development. He'll assist me if I get too deep in the woods here. I'm going to work from a set of slides that we have our response. They say Minnesota's Workforce Program on the bottom. Let me begin, though, by thanking Ms. Hauer and her team and Auditor Nobles for their work. In a discussion we had, we think this is the first time the legislative auditor has been asked to look specifically at these programs. They looked at Workforce Center systems and at MNSCU's vocational programs, but we found it very helpful to have this work done. And we agree with virtually all of the recommendations, and I'd like to go through those and comment on how we think we can learn from what they have suggested. I'll try and go through this relatively quickly. Then we also know that the Workforce Center Association is here and MNSCU. But starting with major finding one, the workforce programs are diffuse, and to some extent because of federal law and the distinction as to where various programs are housed. And we work closely with our partners to make them as, if the opposite of diffuse is fused, to make them work together. But it isn't easy. When I was a legislator, I recall saying that these federal programs came with federal rule books that required carts to carry them. And that wasn't a far exaggeration, except they now all come on multiple CD-ROMs to keep track of them. And require things like vocational rehabilitation supervisors have to report up through a chain of command to the statewide director and can't have cross-program reporting. And we find ways to make them work. It's not simple. Our national association, the National Association of State Workforce Agencies, along with the National Association of Workforce Service Areas, is working with the federal Congress to hope to make some changes in the renewal of the Workforce Investment Act that might make some of those programs less siloed. In the absence of that, we are working with the Workforce Center Association and others to try and make the programs work as well together as they can, but the connections are complex and the funding is limited. finding number two on page three, programs are only partially integrated with unemployment insurance, adult basic education, and some training programs. What I can do the most about is the connection to unemployment insurance. And some of you remember that up until about a decade ago, one went to a local office then called the unemployment office. Those have changed. The unemployment insurance system has become both more automated and more centralized and more complicated. And in order to meet the performance requirements that I mentioned in our presentation earlier in this meeting, the expertise is concentrated in two call centers, one in St. Cloud and one in St. Paul. But we are anxious to try and find a way. The recommendation the auditor has made is that we try and find a way to directly connect people in workforce centers to a customer service agent without going through the automated phone system. We'll look at that carefully. We're concerned about the impact that will have on waiting times for other people, but we take that seriously. We also have coming up the first week of March a lean office process called a Kaizen event to bring together expertise in the business processes in workforce centers, job seeker services, and unemployment insurance to try and find better ways to connect these customers and address that gap. In terms of MNSCU and adult basic education,
there's a question from Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, aren't the people who work in the workforce centers conversant in how to show potential people who walk in the door who have no idea how to get the benefits to use a computer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, yes, and we think that they do that, and we've added people through ARRA funding to do that.
I don't think the auditor said that, though. They said they aren't being they aren't being helped when they come in the door.
And we can ask Ms. Hauer to clarify. Our understanding is that when they're looking for specific information about their account, whether they're eligible under their unique set of circumstances, how many weeks they might qualify, what the process is to get on emergency unemployment or extended benefits, that the people in workforce centers have been trained to have them call St. Paul because it is incredibly complicated, and we don't want to take the risk of someone in a workforce center giving them the wrong information. Yes, we can help them get on the website or on the telephone. What we have not tried to do is duplicate the expertise in the 49 workforce centers to answer complex individual questions.
So are they able to access a telephone if they're at a workforce development center so they could at least get them, but we're still having problems with them being able to use the automated phone system to get to the particular assistance?
Madam Chair, in many workforce centers, either our employee or a partner employee will literally help them get through the prompts if English is limited or if it's a challenge for them. But even that at times leaves them dissatisfied and frustrated. They come in hoping to get some face-to-face help, and they get, as Ms. Hauer described it, a face-to-machine interface. And we're hoping to get them at least a voice-to-voice interface. I need to do that sensitive to the fact that 30,000 people a week call us, and right now we're at five-minute wait times, and I don't want those wait times to be much longer than that. So we will take the legislative auditor's advice, but we're going to do it get a lot of smart people around figuring out how to do it.
Because, Madam Chair,
Senator Tomassoni,
it seems to me they're being told, go back on the computer or go make a phone call. They're not being helped on how to do it. That's what I'm getting from the auditor. And I'm wondering if the people in the workforce centers just don't know how to help them. And given the fact that 84% of the people are applying online already, these are a minimal number of people who are having trouble, and they're probably new people who have been laid off for the first time and have never done it before. So I'm just wondering why the workforce centers themselves aren't able to be more helpful.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Tomassoni, representatives of the workforce centers are here, and they can address that directly. What I have found is that we have a lot of nice people that work in workforce centers, and
I'm not
best.
I'm trying to criticize them. It sounds to me like they probably don't have the expertise to help people that walk in, and I'm just wondering if that's the case here.
So perhaps we could have that addressed when they come forward. Would that be a good?
We can, but let me just.
Okay.
It is true that we're not training the people in the workforce centers to answer very detailed unemployment insurance questions because they are so complex that they should be addressed by the experts in our service center. Even in the customer service center, we have specialists that deal with veterans issues or seasonal workers or people with multi-state experience during the same incident of unemployment. They get really complicated. And we try to get people in the workforce centers to help people get to the help they need, but they don't always have the answers.
So we have two questions. First from Senator Kolk and then Senator Bonoff. Senator Kolk?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And two to Senator Tomassoni's question. I think if we could have maybe a reiteration, because what I understood from Senator Bonoff's answer is that the Workforce Center people do try to help people through the computer process or through the phone process, but because of their other Workforce Center duties and obviously an increase in the number of clientele, they are not finding even the time to do that, not necessarily expertise for a simple situation or just to get you on the computer and here's where you click and a walkthrough, but that there's time limitation factors. And so maybe we could talk about, is there a way to address that? And perhaps not. But.
Madam Chair, Senator Koch, we have certainly heard some of that. It has gotten better since we got about 80 people added in workforce centers that are funded by ARA stimulus money. That money, however, runs out this coming fall. And if workloads continue to be high, we will again face those shortages of staff in workforce centers. A number of the workforce centers have been working hard to improve their processes, and they really I think Jerry Vistam is going to come up from the Anoka County Workforce Center. He can address this. It isn't simple with these levels of workloads. We had more than 100,000 people sign into our resource rooms last year. That's a lot of people that need help. We're continuing to look for better and better ways to get them help. We also understand limited resources in a time of high unemployment.
There, and a question from Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Senator Koch really said exactly what I was going to say, that my understanding from Ms. Hoyer was just what she said, that it really was a question in many cases of just having the time and patience to sit next to somebody, and it really wasn't about expertise.
Very good.
Yeah. And we're concerned about both, and we try to avoid having people guess and give wrong answers, but also make as much time as they can.
So obviously there are a lot of questions about making sure people have the support they need.
You've said several times now the word complicated. Why isn't it simple?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, with the door open and I wasn't able to hear Senator Tomasoni.
You said the word complicated several times now in your presentation here, and I'm just wondering why isn't it simple? I mean, I've actually had some people tell me that they'd rather apply for Wisconsin benefits than Minnesota benefits because it's so much easier to get them.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, what they also I hope tell you is they wouldn't want to be compensated at Wisconsin's benefit levels.
It all depends because in some cases they're better, but
not usually. On average,
very good. Well, I think we have some further work here, Senator Tomasoni, to work on these issues.
I want to know about the simple.
You want to know about the simple.
We follow the law as set both by this body and the federal Congress, and I assure you it isn't simple. Now, if someone comes in who has had a handful of employers and they're laid off for lack of work, they will tell you it was pretty simple. I talked to a sheetrocker who'd had 29 employers during his qualifying period, needed to tell us who they were and how much he'd worked with each of them. They were in 8 states. That's not simple. You add to that people who may have had a period of incarceration during their base period or have it just goes on and on. Some cases are simple, and we bring Mr. Nelson back. The vast majority are, but the ones that are not get incredibly complicated. And I think it's not surprising to me that it would be complicated. If
okay.
I could go back to the presentation.
Very good. Thank you, Commissioner.
Right.
I think that, you know, it is an area of interest, I can tell, to the committee. So
it is. It's always interesting. It's important because so many people are collecting benefits right now. You know, about 5% of Minnesota's population are collecting benefits, and that's a lot of people. The coordination between our programs and MnSCU's programs and with adult basic education are something we work on all the time. ABE itself is fairly complicated. As you'll see on page 4, there are 52 ABE consortiums around the state. They're administered through the Minnesota Department of Education. They each have their own ways of working with us. We have, I think, approximately 20 to deliver classes in the workforce center. Some of them are co-located with us. We're engaged in 4 kind of very intense collaborations that were part of a bill passed by Senator Clark last year that have asked us to, under the leadership of the workforce councils, convene all the partners from Head Start, Early Childhood, K-12, Adult Basic Education, MnSCU, and our programs. And those 4 collaborations are shown here. Stearns-Benton in the St. Cloud area, the Greater Twin Cities Metro Workforce Council, Workforce Development, Inc. is in southeastern Minnesota, headquartered in Rochester, the Ramsey County WIB. And they are working on essentially a pilot basis to find ways of more tightly integrating these various prosperity systems. We also have a project called Minnesota Fast Track that's funded in part by a Joyce Foundation grant and in part by 2 federal funding sources that, again, are intended more to coordinate adult basic education with our community and technical colleges and our workforce programs and are beginning to address some of the gaps that we acknowledge exist and shown in the report Ms. Hauer indicated.
Good.
Page 5, the legislative appropriations. I don't have a lot to say about it. We do our very best to monitor these. There is a federal law that says we cannot use any of our federal resources or federally funded employees to monitor state grants. With that said, we are determined to do more monitoring. We'll continue to try and negotiate monitoring resources with grantees. The legislative auditor has suggested we make a proposal to you on how we would fund that, and we'll be happy to have some discussions about what that might be. Major finding three and number six, we say in our material that we disagree with the Job Skills Partnership or with the recommendation that the Job Skills Partnership should establish a competitive process for awarding grants to providers of workers affected by small layoffs. As Ms. Hauer explained this to you and to the House this morning, we understand her recommendation a little more. I was concerned that what they wanted us to do is to take all the money that's used for small layoffs, including that allocated by formula to the workforce service areas, and make it competitive. We didn't think that was workable. I understand now that their recommendation is that the money provided to independent grantees, and there are three of them currently, be more competitive. And we think that's a reasonable recommendation, and we'll look at finding a way to do that. It will not. It may have some political implications because those are principally organized labor-based organizations. The page four, major finding four on page seven, monitoring activities. Again, we talked about this a little earlier. We're committed to do the monitoring that's required for state grants and independent grants. It would be helpful to have some additional resources. On page 8, we agree that federal performance measures are inadequate. We are working to develop some additional measures. The legislature gave us some direction, and we have been working to accomplish that. The first phase of that report came to you in October. We will have some additional information on workforce programs at the end of this year.
So back on page 7, when you have the recommendation that you would support a grant program to have a more competitive process, do you think that if there was a more competitive process that we would be able to, because there is greater competition, provide greater services for the same cost or less? Or do you think that the grants that are being given now are we're getting as much service as possible from them? Maybe that's a difficult question, but or hypothetical.
Madam Chair, it would be interesting to have some of the providers comment on that. Competition always seems to be a good thing and to increase the creativity and the innovation in the delivery of services. With that said, the entities that are delivering services that are not competitive today, that are sort of the traditional providers, do good work. And I acknowledge that the legislative auditor's conclusion that the best practices is to increase competition, and I think they're right. But it will be interesting to see if in these rather specialized fields the competition increases quality. It cannot hurt. I don't see how it can hurt.
Okay, thank you.
Page 9, workforce program clients generally achieve better job and wage outcomes than similar people who didn't participate in workforce programs. We need to do a better job, and we got some suggestions from the legislative auditor. We have only done satisfaction surveys based essentially on the federal measures and on service delivery rather than outcomes. I will point out that the period of time during which the legislative auditor during which the people surveyed by the legislative auditor were served were between July of 2007 and the end of 2009, which was a period when connecting people to jobs was very difficult because so few employers were hiring. But we are taking some action to better connect the registration for programs like We Adult and Dislocated Workers to our MinnesotaWorks.net platform and other things we do to connect to employers. And so we take to heart their finding that we do great training, we give great services, and people don't feel we've done enough to get them in front of employers. Some of that work individuals have to do, but we'll try and find ways to be as helpful as we can. We will roll out the first week in March a direct computer connection between our what we call customer registration system in the workforce centers and the MinnesotaWorks.net. So instead of having to sign up twice, people will only have to sign up once and will be signed up to submit their resumes for jobs. And we hope that will help with that connection. On page 10, most workforce clients surveyed felt favorably about the availability of services, but fewer felt we've connected them to jobs, as I just commented on that, kind of ahead of schedule. Then the last item was a recommendation that workforce service areas be decided on a case-by-case basis, and there was no proven benefit to changing workforce service areas or to arbitrarily co-locating workforce centers with Minsky campuses. That's consistent with our policy. We agree with that. We have said that in the event there was a reduction in performance, we may have to consider changing workforce service areas. We don't anticipate that that will happen. We've been very happy with the six workforce service areas that are on Minsky campuses, but each of those is decided in consultation with the local workforce service area and with the Minsky institution.
Very good.
David, did I forget anything?
You got it.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Is Kathy Weick here from the Minnesota Workforce Council Association to testify? And Mr. Vithum, are you here as
yes,
well? Very good. Thank you very much. Ms. Weick, if you'd like to begin.
I will.
Introduce yourself.
Thank you. I am Kathy Weick, and I serve as the chair of the Minnesota Workforce Council Association, and I chair the Dakota Scott Workforce Board. And my day job, I'm Senior Vice President of Administration for Stratus Health. And I'm just going to make a few comments. I really have the expert with me, Jerry Vitsum, who's our director of Anoka County. I just wanted to comment that we appreciate that the report was asked for and the results of the report. It's an extremely complex system. We play a part of it, but I really think the report has done a fine job of helping understand how that system comes together. And I actually will be requiring, if there is such a way, Chapter 1, which is the background information, is required reading for all our WIB board members. We have, and you will see within the report, Minnesota Workforce Council Association was also able to review the report and made some comments, and our recommendation letter, or our letter, is within the packet, and I will certainly know you each are able to read that. There are several recommendations we do agree with, and then the only other thing I might want to comment on before turning it to Jerry for your questions, especially follow up on the questions around the UI and the workforce centers, is that we fully agree the importance of good measures, good evaluation schemes. We would like to ask that we are able to participate in development of those, and that the job of collecting data and doing evaluation doesn't become a job in itself. Our goal really is to be in the service centers serving those individuals coming in to meet our need our services. So let me turn it to Jerry, and if you have any general comments.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, I'm just reading the report, Senator Bonoff, but thank you.
Madam Chair, I don't see that letter in
my
packet.
It's in the very back. It's like three pages from the back and the appendix. There's Mr. Noble's letters and then the letter from Ms. White.
Madam Chair, thank you. I thought it was separate.
I was just
actually
looking at that when you caught me. So.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I thought I could maybe address the specific question you had. As mentioned, we had a chance to review the proposal. We thought there are a number of great suggestions, great insight for workforce board members to read. Kind of points out the complications of our system and the conflicting federal rules and state rules and different programs, and it's really a very nice summary of the workforce system in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. It's really a nice piece of work. In terms of the unemployment insurance, I think I can answer what the problem is in the workforce centers. Generally, when people come in, we'll help them sit down on a computer, go through the unemployment application and so forth. And if they don't want to do it that way, we have phones that they can use to do the phone calls. We can help them if they have a question. The problem is some of the cases are very complicated, and we don't have the expertise to answer those questions. I think what the auditor was recommending, we think is a very good solution, is that we have a direct line to that system to be able to help in those cases where we can't help them. The other problem we have is that we don't get paid to do this. Most of our business is mainly the employment end of the business. We're helping people look for work. And so any time that we spend doing unemployment, which often can be up to the quarter of our time, doing that, using up time on the computers and our staff time, is not spent on helping people find work. So that's a concern. So if there's some way to get some resource to help us pay for that, that would be very helpful. So those are the suggestions we would have, is that that phone be available, and then if some resources could, so that we could help with people that need to do the more one-on-one kind of thing on the computer, it would be very helpful. Just to give you an idea, in my workforce center, we see about 400 to 600 people a day. That's a lot of people looking for work, having questions about unemployment insurance. We get no real direct funding other than a small Wagner-Peiser allocation to handle the basic services. Basically, we put those services together by stealing a little money from each of the grants that we get and trying to cobble that together. And particularly in these times of high unemployment, it really taxes the resources of the workforce centers.
So has there been any use of volunteers, and not to replace staff, but to enhance it? I know that the Yellow Ribbon Coalition is putting together a jobs initiative for their returning the Red Bulls, who have a high unemployment rate, and trying to look at developing some mentors, some job mentors who could work with them one-on-one, and which is certainly a very intensive program. But has there any been ever thought to having retired folks maybe be there to discuss, do some support groups, anything? Is that anything that would be appropriate to be able to stretch the services that we have right now? And again, not to replace staff, yes, but to enhance where you're seeing the needs?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we do use volunteers in the mm-hmm. resource area. We also use a heavy use of special employment programs like senior community service employment, mm-hmm. where we're bringing back seniors to work in the public sector. And in our resource area, all the initial work that's done with participants in terms of explaining programs mm-hmm. and access is all done by that group of, mm-hmm. of seniors. So we are using that service. There's more you can do. However, you know, the whole system can be fairly complex,
right,
in terms of where do you look for work, how do you work for work, the questions, should I do this, can mm-hmm. you look at my resume? And those are pretty complicated things sometimes. So, yes, there is definitely opportunity for volunteers, but there's also need for professional staff.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I do know that on page 73 about Minsky, that one of the comments is that because of Minsky's academic calendar, that some laid-off workers have to wait months before they begin a training session. I know that then, because you're trying to work with Minsky, is that a significant problem, or do you see that as something that we need to work with Minsky to determine how that program could be more flexible with some folks?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would say yes, that's definitely something that could be helpful. An example is when you you get laid off in January, the school has just started. The primary starts for school are in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are collecting unemployment for 6 months or 8 months before you can get into school. Now, I would say in our area, and I think most parts of the state, Minsky has been very responsive during this recessionary period to try to get more open entry. And in ours, we had lots of different areas that were filled, the programs were filled, and they opened up new sections to let more people in January. We're seeing a lot more summer starts than we used to see, a lot more summer school available. But it definitely used to be easier because we used to have quarter starts in Minnesota before we had the semester starts. That really complicated it because there's a lot fewer starts. But I would say the schools have been trying their darndest. I would say in their defense, it's pretty difficult to have an increase of 20-some percent in your enrollments and have your money cut in terms of services. It's hard to be that flexible. And I'm sure it's more expensive for them to have multiple starts.
Very good. Any other questions? Well, I want to thank everyone for being here today and providing us with a very comprehensive overview of this very important program to our state at this point in time. And I'm wondering if we have some ideas of our next meeting schedule. We are meeting Monday, with an agenda to be determined. So we will see you on Monday, and with that, the meeting is adjourned.